So I've been very fortunate to have had Emmanuel as my main advisor for many years. He's had a very deep impact on the way I think about the world, and I think you will see his influence all over this project. And I'm very grateful for the organizers to put together this opportunity to be in the company of so many who were also very close to him and meet many of you in person for the first time. And so with that, I'm going to present a paper on optimal monetary policy with heterogeneous agents, and this is joint work with Eduardo, who is also here. We see substantial heterogeneity in households' exposure to business cycle fluctuations. And at the same time, there's a growing consensus that monetary policy itself has distributional consequences. That's a view supported by mounting empirical evidence and an important takeaway from the burgeoning heterogeneous agent New Keynesian literature. Even the Fed seems to be increasingly taking into consideration, quote unquote, distributional considerations. After concluding their long-term strategic review in August 2020, Chairman Powell said the following: "Our revised statement emphasizes that maximum employment is a broad-based and inclusive goal. This change reflects our appreciation for the benefits of a strong labor market, particularly for many in low and moderate income communities." And so with that, the question we ask in this paper is, what are the implications of household heterogeneity for the way we should think about optimal monetary policy? We develop a what we call timeless Ramsey approach to think jointly about the implications of household heterogeneity for three distinct dimensions of policy design. The question of long-run optimal policy or long-run optimal inflation, the question of target design and time consistency, and lastly, the question of optimal stabilization policy in response to shocks. Along the way, we're going to extend the recently increasingly popular sequence-based apparatus to Ramsey problems and welfare analysis. And using all of this, we're going to systematically revisit the New Keynesian optimal monetary policy consensus. In particular, there are going to be five major takeaways. Zero inflation remains the optimal long-run policy, at least in our baseline economy. Two, the standard Barrow-Gordon inflation target has to get augmented by distributional considerations. And there is a second source of time consistency problem that requires a novel distributional target in addition to the inflation target. Going to stabilization, we're going to show that divine coincidence generically fails in these economies. And we also characterize the solution under discretion, show that there is value and gains from commitment even in the absence of cost push shocks. We naturally speak to the vast literature on optimal monetary policy in the standard New Keynesian setting, as well as several recent papers that think about this in the heterogeneous agent context, including Mike Golovsov's recent Econometrica. And relative to these, we sort of have four main contributions. First, our timeless Ramsey approach allows us to jointly think about these three dimensions of policy: long-run policy, targets, and stabilization. Then we're going to spend quite a bit of time taking the sequence-based apparatus to Ramsey problems in heterogeneous agent economies, because that's what really makes this tractable and operational. We solve for optimal policy under discretion. And what I'm going to spend a lot of time on today is we have analytical targeting rules for optimal policy in these economies that will be insightful when we want to compare heterogeneous agent and representative agent economies. We also speak to this long literature following, say in this context, Barrow-Gordon, on targeting rules and the question of time consistency. And in particular, we extend the Marcet-Marimon recursive multiplier approach to continuous time heterogeneous agent economies. And for the rest of the talk, I will show you the baseline model. I'll then walk you through our main analytical results. And if there is time, I'll show you how to leverage, in particular, sequence-based methods to do quantitative analysis for optimal policy in these economies. And unless there are questions, we can jump right into the model. Time will be continuous and there is no aggregate risk, which means we focus on one-time unanticipated shocks. In our baseline model, we deliberately take a minimal departure from the standard representative agent New Keynesian model, which I will refer to as rank. We introduce incomplete markets and uninsurable earnings risk, and we go from price rigidity to wage rigidity. We allow for three types of shocks: discount rate or demand shocks, supply or TFP shocks, and cost push shocks. And in terms of welfare criteria, given the time constraints today, I will mostly talk about equal weighted utilitarian. I'll have some things to say about an aggregate efficiency criterion, but then we also have a separate paper that allows us to think about the implications of alternative normative considerations for optimal policy design. I just want to flag that here. Okay, here are the details. I will spend quite a bit of time on walking you through every equation that will then show up in the actual planning problem, so that we're really that we're all sort of seeing the structure of the problem. So we will define households' private lifetime utility as V, and that's the expected net present value of all future instantaneous utility flows. Households face this budget constraint. They can trade a bond, they face a borrowing constraint, and they have three sources of income: financial income, where R denotes the real interest rate; labor income, where W is the real wage and Z is idiosyncratic labor productivity; and tau is simply a lump sum rebate from the government, but this will be zero in equilibrium. Now, there will be heterogeneity in this economy, and we will denote the joint density over income and wealth by this G object. There's no ex ante heterogeneity, though, which means that we can identify households with their ex post states, Z and A for income and wealth. And so if you want to aggregate in this economy, for example, if you want aggregate consumption, you will just integrate the micro object, say the consumption policy function, against this cross-sectional distribution. We use an off-the-shelf model of nominal wage rigidity. And what does that mean? There will be labor rationing, so all households work the same hours. Unions will pay a quadratic Rotenberg adjustment cost whenever they want to change their nominal wages, and that cost is passed back to households as a direct utility cost. There are alternative ways of modeling this, which we explore in the paper, but for the talk today, let's keep it simple. And all of this gives you the New Keynesian wage Phillips curve in this environment, which for all intents and purposes behaves exactly the same as the price Phillips curve that you may be more familiar with. And let's just walk through. So this is a differential equation in inflation. You see the slope of the Phillips curve is just epsilon over delta. Delta is the cost of adjustments. And then what do unions do here? Unions target a desired markup over some aggregate of individual labor wages, which is much like the price Phillips curve that you're used to. And to make this very concrete, let's walk through a simple example. Suppose there are no cost push shocks, so the epsilons are all constant. And suppose we set the employment subsidy so that there's no desired markup. Then if we take the flex price limit, which is taking the adjustment cost delta to zero, unions will set the real wage equal to the average marginal rate of substitution between consumption and labor in this economy. On the production side, there is a representative firm that produces the final consumption good using a linear technology and labor. We will assume perfect competition of flexible prices, which just means that real wages will be equal to the marginal product of labor, which is productivity. And so in this economy, we will have wages being equal to the marginal rate of transformation, but they may not be equal to the marginal rate of substitution. Yeah, unions, think of them as in the background. They do the following. They do the following things. All households work for the unions. The unions make everyone work the same. That's where labor rationing comes from. And then in the standard New Keynesian way of modeling it, the unions produce a differentiated service that gets bundled and then sold as the aggregate labor input. And that's where the Phillips curve comes from. The fiscal authority is very simple. It pays for the employment subsidy with a proportional lump sum tax, and we will focus on monetary policy. The only policy instrument we consider today is the path of nominal interest rates, I. There's a Fisher relation which says the real interest rate is nominal interest rate minus inflation, and we can get CPI inflation from nominal wage inflation and productivity growth. There is a goods and bond market clearing condition, and the definition of equilibrium is standard. Let me summarize the model by discussing the sources of inefficiency or suboptimality here. The first two you all know from the standard New Keynesian model. There is monopolistic competition and nominal rigidities. What's new here is there's labor rationing and there are incomplete markets. Now, the labor rationing assumption is a little bit artificial, and so we're not going to try to focus too much on it. What we really care about is incomplete markets, which means that households will not be able to equalize their marginal rates of substitution across dates and states or histories. Okay, any questions at this point about the structure of the model? I can't tell if you all get it or if you all want dinner. Okay, let's move on. So let me talk about how to think about optimal policy in this context. This slide is very important because here's where we construct the planning problem. We will follow the primal approach. In the paper, we also characterize the dual. This just means that the planner will pick among implementable competitive equilibria. We will say that the standard primal Ramsey problem maximizes a Lagrangian L, taking as given the initial cross-sectional income and wealth distribution. What is that L? First, the planner is going to maximize the net present value of some weighted average of utility flows, and we're going to allow for welfare weights omega. For the talk, in the interest of time, I will show you equations that set these omegas to 1 for everyone, which is just equal weighted utilitarian. Now, the planner has to respect competitive equilibrium, which translates into 5 implementability conditions that I will walk you through very carefully now. First, even though the planner can pick consumption in this planning problem, she has to respect households' private consumption savings decisions. They take the standard first order condition form, which just says households want to equalize marginal utility from consumption to the private marginal value of wealth. Now, because the private marginal value of wealth shows up here on the right-hand side, the planner also has to respect the definition of that value. And that's the typical Bellman equation that you're familiar with. In continuous time, this is a Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, but the structure is just the same. So you have the lifetime value being the instantaneous utility flow plus the continuation value. We're going to use the Lagrange multiplier phi for the HJB. That's going to be one of the most important objects of the talk. Furthermore, the planner internalizes that any policy decision will affect the evolution of the entire income and wealth distribution in this economy. And so the planner also has to respect the law of motion of that distribution, which takes the form of a Kolmogorov forward equation. It simply says how the distribution moves over time, left-hand side, is equal to some form of transition matrix or operator, lambda KFE times G. And it just tracks literally how households move from one place to another across time. We're going to put the Lagrange multiplier lambda on this constraint, and that summarizes the micro block. The macro block is very simple, and it's the exact same that you would have in the representative agent benchmark. There's a resource constraint, which you get from putting the production function together with goods market clearing, and there is the Phillips curve, which we already talked about. For the Phillips curve, we use the Lagrange multiplier theta, which will also be very important. To summarize all this, we're going to say that a Ramsey plan is a solution to this problem. And in particular, it comprises the time paths for allocations and prices, optimal policy, and these 5 multipliers. Now, if you want to be very concrete, the structure of this Ramsey plan is essentially that you have time paths for 11 unknowns. And where do you get them from? You get them from 5 implementability conditions and 6 first order conditions from the Ramsey problem. And for the rest of the talk, we're going to really try to unpack these optimality conditions and get all of the economic intuition out of them. Any questions on this slide? All right. So let's make one important observation here. Optimal policy under the standard Ramsey plan will conflate three distinct motives for adjusting policy. The planner will perceive what you may call steady state distortions and want to respond to those. The planner will be subject to time consistency problems, which will influence policy in the short run. And then finally, there's the pure stabilization motive, which is sort of what you care about when you want to think about shocks. The timeless Ramsey approach that I'm going to outline now is designed to separate these three out and in particular characterize three dimensions of policy design in the following way. And on this slide, I'm going to give you an incredibly intuitive account of this. The first thing you want to do as the planner or the central bank is you want to figure out what's your favorite inflation rate in the long run, say 20 years from now. Because in the long run, shocks don't really matter and the time consistency problems you're exposed to today don't really matter. Figure that out. We're going to call that solution the stationary Ramsey plan. Then I'm going to ask you, well, suppose I give you the stationary Ramsey plan today. Do you want to put that same inflation rate that you like so much for the long run, including today? The answer is going to be no. And that's because of time consistency problems. And so realizing this, we're going to ask, can we design a target or penalty such that when a planner is confronted with that penalty, that planner will want to choose the long run optimal. And that's going to be very much like the Barrow-Gordon type inflation target logic that you may know. Finally, once we've put these two elements together, we can ask the question, now suppose you're confronted with a demand shock, supply shock, or cost push shock, how do you actually want to respond? Critically, having isolated out steady state distortion, incentives, and time consistency problems. Okay, and with that, we're going to just jump right into the first of these three steps. And to get going, I'm going to walk you through three of the first order conditions that come out of the Ramsey problem. The first order condition for the cross-sectional distribution defines the social lifetime value, lambda, and it solves this Bellman equation. And you'll notice this Bellman equation looks just like the private Bellman equation. You have value, instantaneous private utility flow, and then continuation value. Except now there are two additional terms on the right-hand side, and those capture whatever the planner internalizes that private agents don't. In particular, the very right-hand side object is going to be this labor wedge that Ivan just talked about for in the context of their model. So the intuition being, I'll anticipate here, but suppose we give wealth to a household that has a very high MPC and we happen to have a recession, the planner is going to value that in a way that private agents would not. Yes, please. No, this is recursive, so, excuse me, AT is, it's not the initial state. All you need to know from the initial state is the initial cross-sectional distribution over AT, AZ, and then AZ is in any period. So you will have the distribution of households moving around for fixed AZ. Okay, great. Now, I think, Yvonne, you had essentially this equation. Let's figure out what's different in this context. So this is the first order condition for the optimal interest rate I. And we're going to target we're going to care about three effects. The first two are encoded in this first object, and then I'll talk about the third one. So forget about the third one for now. The first object has two forces. First, imagine you change interest rates. What do? You redistribute dollar resources across households in proportion to their wealth, which is A. When you redistribute dollars, you're effectively redistributing utils in proportion to marginal utility, which would be the private marginal value of wealth. That's the first object in there. And that is a distributive pecuniary effect because to the extent that the planner values some agents more than others, we are redistributing towards those. Then there's the Keynesian effect, which is why this isn't just the private marginal value of wealth here, but rather the social marginal value of wealth. The Keynesian effect just says, much like in Ivan's discussion, if you redistribute dollars, not utils, to high MPC households and we're happening to be in a recession, well, that's good for us and we want to internalize this. Now let's talk about the third effect. I will have a lot to say about penalties, so bear with me, but phi is what we will call the distributional penalty. It's the shadow cost that the planner faces at time t for redistributing value or utils in the cross section. And for now, just think of this, you wake up with a cost of doing this, that's the cost you face, and so if you have a high cost of redistributing utils to a household, you're going to get penalized for that. I'll have a lot to say about that, specifically the phi object. Okay, finally, here's...
What happened
to the friend weights? So the general welfare weights are going to are set to 1 in all of these equations. We have the more general case for you, but for the talk today, they're just going to be equal weighted utilitarian. The first order condition for inflation is this. Similar to the distributional penalty, we call theta, which recall is the Lagrange multiplier on the Phillips curve, the inflation penalty. And this equation tells you that theta changes over time proportionally to inflation and this complicated term that we just set to 0 using interest rates. That tells you that sort of inflation and nominal interest rates have symmetric distributional consequences in the simple baseline model. And now we can use this to ask the long run question. To do so, we're going to formally define the stationary Ramsey plan as the Ramsey plan itself as time sort of goes to the long run, which means that shocks have dissipated and time inconsistency is no longer relevant. And the first result is planners in this baseline Hank economy agree with planners in the representative agent New Keynesian model on 0 optimal long-run wage inflation. This is very straightforward. Under the stationary Ramsey plan, everything must be constant, including this inflation penalty. It cannot change over time. If you plug that into its law of motion, you just see that inflation has to be 0. The economic intuition, which is also straightforward, is that in this very simple baseline economy, the nominal interest rate and wage inflation have symmetric distributional consequences. This would no longer be the case, for example, in an economy where households systematically have different consumption baskets and therefore face different price indices. Okay, now we're going to what I find to be the much more interesting part of this policy problem, namely the question of what are the time consistency problems in this economy and how can we think about them in the design of targets. So again, the following thought hypothetical. We figured out optimal long-run policy. Suppose I just hand you the stationary Ramsey plan with that optimal policy. Do you want to stay there, even if there are no shocks? The answer is no. And let's think very carefully why that is. In this economy, the planner faces two forward-looking constraints, the Phillips curve and Bellman equations. Therefore, the planner wants to leverage the ability to make promises about future inflation and about future value assignments, right? Because those promises will affect behavior today, which the planner can leverage. And we're solving the Ramsey problem under commitment. Now, what does that mean mechanically? If I'm the planner and I want to make a promise today, how do I do that in a sort of time-consistent way? I pick a penalty for my future self such that if future self wakes up, sees that penalty, they want to do exactly what I promised today. And those are going to be the two Lagrange multipliers or co-states, theta and phi, on those two forward-looking constraints. That's essentially the Marcet-Marimon intuition. But at time t, in the standard Ramsey problem way, there are no past promises. And so at time zero, at the start of the world, I haven't promised anything before the start of the world. So at time zero, I can pick inflation and value completely freely. That's where time inconsistency comes from. And so formally, the standard Ramsey plan that I just showed you has the initial conditions, theta and phi, at time zero, being zero. Whereas on the other hand, we know that in the long run, the planner wants to make promises, and so in the long run, these two objects will generically not be zero. And that discrepancy is the content of time inconsistency in this context. For the next few slides, we're going to answer this question. Can we design a set of penalties and targets, T, such that a planner confronted with T internalizes the time consistency problem? And the answer is yes. And just to anticipate, this will be Barrow-Gordon plus. We're going to have an inflation target that's just like Barrow-Gordon, except it will be augmented by distributional considerations. And then, because there is the second source of time inconsistency, there will be a new target required for policy to actually be time consistent. Okay, here's one of the key objects of the paper. We define timeless penalties as this object T, which is a function of phi, any phi and theta that you want to plug in. And it has two components. It has a distributional penalty and it has an inflation penalty. And I'll unpack those in the next few slides. Think of the inflation penalty as the standard linear Barrow-Gordon penalty that you know. And this is where we sort of generalize the recursive multiplier approach of Marcet-Marimon to continuous time heterogeneous agent economies. Now we're going to introduce the timeless primal Ramsey problem as maximizing an augmented Lagrangian LTP, where we just take the standard Lagrangian I showed you before, but now add the penalty. So it's very straightforward. It's just like the central bank wakes up today and you hand the central banker the inflation target. The formal result is the following. Denote paths of policy by I and shocks by Z. Then this condition holds, and I'll walk you through in words. Suppose we initialize the economy at the standard stationary Ramsey plan, which means we just initialize it with GSS in the stationary steady state. And we set the timeless penalties exactly to the stationary multiplier values. Then in the absence of shocks, which means setting Z to steady state Z, stationary Ramsey policy will be optimal, which means the planner wants to pick I from the steady state. And what does this condition sort of formally say? It says, consider any perturbation di, you're not going to improve on just stationary Ramsey policy. So this is the idea of, if you're the Fed or any planner, and you are telling me, well, in 20 years, I kind of like 2% inflation, but today I might like 3% for whatever reasons, then these penalties will make it such that today your answer will also be 2% in the absence of shocks. Any questions here? All right. So, obviously, we now want to look at these inflation and distributional targets or penalties, right? We want to sort of understand what's driving them. And to do that, we will introduce distributional wedges as the summary statistics for the role that household heterogeneity plays in this economy. Let's go through them slowly. This economy features cross-sectional dispersion and marginal utilities, which means that the planner's valuation of a marginal dollar of resource will be different than in a representative agent model. That's the first term. The planner also faces this distributional penalty that encodes past promises. So under commitment, again, you can make promises about the future under a Ramsey problem. Now, if you wake up in the future, the way that mechanically works is you're facing the shadow cost or penalty phi. And that's going to be different in the cross-section because you've made different promises to different households. And so when you set policy at time t, you will face this distributional penalty, which is the shadow cost of corresponding to the promises you've made in the past. Now, crucially, in large part because of this labor wedge and Keynesian, you may call it aggregate demand externality, the planner will generically perceive that households are either oversaving or undersaving. In other words, the planner would like to distort households' private consumption savings decisions. And chi, the Lagrange multiplier on that first order condition, which I showed you earlier, is precisely that shadow cost that encodes that incentive. It's like saying, you know, we have a recession today. Ideally, I would like households not to save as much, but I have to respect their private consumption savings decisions, right? Because all instruments I have is the path of the aggregate nominal interest rate. I can't pick everyone's consumption savings decisions. That chi is the shadow cost that responds to that. And then lastly, heterogeneity will, crucially inform the way labor wedges work here. Because we saw that what matters in the Phillips curve is this sort of cross-sectional aggregate labor wedge. But then when I change consumption and labor supply differently in the cross-section, there will be these cross-sectional implications. And that's the Keynesian effect. Great. Let's make some sanity checks here. First, in a representative agent-New Keynesian model, these distributional wedges are collapsed to one. Furthermore, if instead of doing a utilitarian welfare criterion, we construct a welfare criterion that only cares about aggregate efficiency, even though there is substantial cross-sectional heterogeneity in this economy, we're going to say all we care about is aggregate efficiency, then also these distributional wedges collapse to one, at least in the way that they show up in the following, in the equations that I'm going to show you. Okay, and now we're ready to really get a lot of economics out of this. The timeless penalty I showed you that makes policy time consistent takes the form of a linear Barrow-Gordon inflation target. It just says you get penalized for inflation at time zero in proportion to theta. You can analytically characterize theta in a way that nests both heterogeneous agent and representative agent economies in the following way, with these distributional wedges which collapse to one in rank. This is for isoelastic utility, but you can do this more general in terms of general labor wedges. So let's again think through rank, where we, of course, know the closed form solution for the Barrow-Gordon inflation target. In rank, these distributional wedges collapse to one. Furthermore, if we set the employment subsidy so that unions have no desired markup, then we know employment will be efficient in steady state. And the standard result in this very long literature is that in that special case, we face no time consistency problem on inflation, and the inflation target theta is just zero. In Hank, distributional considerations generically interact with the planner's incentive to, quote unquote, cheat on inflation out of steady state. And we're going to see that even when we set the right the quote-unquote right employment subsidy, because of these distributional wedges that I unpacked on the last slide, you will require an inflation target for policy to be time consistent. So there is, in a very deep sense, an interaction between the time consistency problem arising from the Phillips curve on inflation and the time consistency problem arising from households' consumption savings decisions on redistribution. And again, this entire discussion is for welfare criteria or mandates, if you want to think of it that way, that go beyond aggregate efficiency. Yes? Yes. Yes. So the time consistency problem here shows up at time zero, because you have not been able to make promises in the past. Formally, this shows up as a difference in your first order conditions at time zero and at discretized time one. Now we can also solve this problem Markov, fully discretionary. What will happen is you cannot make promises, right? And then these will sort of have the typical target intuition where this is what you would have to set every period to get the policy to be time consistent. But I think the way you'd like to think about it is there's going to be this discrepancy at time zero and time one in the conditions that describe the Ramsey plan. Yep. Okay, great. Now let's think about the distributional target, which you also need in this economy, above and beyond the inflation target. It takes this form. It's just like the linear penalty for Barrow-Gordon, except you now have a whole cross-section of these, and so you're just integrating or summing over all of these constraints in the cross-section. But whenever phi is negative, it has the exact same intuition. You get penalized for increasing the value of a household that's associated with that negative phi. One of the main results of this paper is that penalties, or sort of the penalties or co-states that encode promises in a commitment solution, solve Kolmogorov forward equations. And we sort of call them promise-keeping Kolmogorov forward equations. And how you see this is, note again, this transition matrix lambda is just from the Kolmogorov forward equation. The intuition is the following. Suppose at time t, you've made promises to households in the cross-section across states. So the state AZ will be corresponding to a promise that you've made in the past. But really, you've made that promise to a household. So in the future, you need to keep track of how that household moves around so that your representation of the promises you've made is still accurate. And that transition of households across time is precisely encoded in this lambda object. And now the forcing term, this partial A chi, is where new promises come from. These are sort of births or deaths of promises. Intuitively, this is all very simple. It just says a utilitarian planner will ex post face an incentive to surprise redistribute, just like you may be used to the language of surprise inflation in the Barrow-Gordon context. And so, like in Barrow-Gordon, we're going to put this distributional penalty, which you see on the left, or distributional target, so that the planner does not face this time-inconsistent incentive to redistribute ex post. And now look at the, one second, look at the structure of this. You'll see that for all indebted households, phi is negative, which means up there, phi shows up as a penalty. So it's precisely saying, in order for policy to be time-consistent, we have to penalize the planner from wanting to surprise redistribute towards indebted households. Yeah, that's a good question. Honestly, I don't have the best answer. I think my favorite interpretation here is that this is quite complicated, and so we should think twice before moving away from an aggregate efficiency mandate for the central bank. but, I mean, literally what it says is you would need a target for the entire distribution. And importantly, it's not enough to just load that into the inflation target. It's a very good question. One that should give us pause when we think about possibly redesigning mandates for institutions that, you know, we would like to behave in a time-consistent way. You also see on the right-hand side that this savings multiplier, which is essentially telling you in what way the planner wants to distort private consumption savings decisions, is uniformly negative. And that's what sort of feeds into this phi. But the intuition comes from here. You want to penalize using monetary policy in a surprise way to redistribute towards indebted households. Okay, this concludes the discussion of targets, penalties, and time consistency. Unless there are questions, let's jump into optimal stabilization policy. And I think this is one of the most useful equations in the paper. So just like Ivan was talking about, you know, mu in his context being the target for the output gap, this equation summarizes everything you want to know about optimal stabilization policy in this economy as a target on the output gap. It says, for arbitrary distributional wedges, you want to set output equal to natural output in a rep agent economy times this big wedge or multiplier. And let's zoom in. So again, in rank, distributional wedges collapse to 1. And so let me show you how you get divine coincidence from this formula. Set the employment subsidy, again, so that you have no desired markups, which means the first term in the numerator sort of goes to 1. And because, it goes to 1 because there is no distributional wedge. Suppose we have a demand shock and conjecture an optimal Ramsey plan that sets inflation to 0. If inflation is 0, we know that theta has to be 0 from the first order condition I showed you before. Now, if you go to the formula up there and you plug in theta equals zero, you are just left with 1/1. And it tells you set output equal to natural output, which means zero output gap, which is precisely the content of divine coincidence in rank. So this is a nonlinear analytical targeting rule that nests both heterogeneous agent and representative agent economies. It collapses down to divine coincidence in the rep agent case, but we have these additional distributional wedges in the heterogeneous agent case. And that's exactly why divine coincidence will generically fail here. The planner will perceive a trade-off between inflation and output on the one hand, which you may think of as aggregate stabilization or aggregate efficiency, and distributional considerations on the other hand. And again, if you just adopted an aggregate efficiency welfare criterion or mandate, you would collapse back down. Now, one very high-level takeaway here is accounting for distributional considerations in monetary policy, when the only instrument is the aggregate nominal interest rate, will come at the cost of aggregate efficiency, which is obvious, but yeah. Okay. We can also do this under discretion. Under discretion, I'm going to go through the slide quickly because I want to talk about how you actually operationalize all of this. Under discretion, the planner takes her future self's actions as given, and so she won't be able to build up these promises over time. And so these promise-keeping multipliers will all be zero, and you can again characterize a targeting rule and sort of, yeah, look at that. But I want to skip that in the interest of showing you how to implement all of this. So, we're going to build on this very important paper by Adrian, Matt, and Ludwig, and extend the sequence space approach or apparatus, which has recently become incredibly popular in this literature, to optimal policy and welfare analysis. That's just a fancy way of saying, I'm going to show you how to do perturbation methods in this economy. So first of all, we're going to adopt a notation where the entire path of policy is denoted by bold-faced I. All the shocks, their time paths are going to be bold-faced Z. And all the macro objects will be bold-faced X. And then because this is optimal policy, we need one more object, which is the time paths of aggregate multipliers M. The first result is, and I'll do this at a high level, but if you have questions, feel free to ask. The first result is that just like we can represent competitive equilibria in sequence space, we can also represent Ramsey plans in sequence space, which have, in addition to the competitive equilibrium conditions, all of the first order conditions corresponding to the planning problem. And in particular, we have this very abstract representation, but don't be fooled, this very abstract representation is very useful in practice. It just says that there exists a map R taking as inputs the time paths of macro aggregates, multipliers, policy, and shocks, such that we can then solve for the Ramsey plan as a function of just the shocks, the initial cross-sectional distribution, which is the initial condition on competitive equilibrium, as well as the timeless penalties that we put to make policy time consistent. Why do we need the timeless penalties here? Well, because if we want a correct first-order approximation of optimal stabilization policy, we do not want it to be confounded by potential time inconsistency. And then, and this is very much like in Ludwig's work, you can bring perturbation methods to bear here to solve for the Ramsey plan or optimal policy to first order. And in particular, you only have to compute two Jacobians. And those Jacobians can be computed very, very fast using the fake news type algorithm that Ludwig, Adrian, and Matt developed with a couple of modifications for the multipliers that are in there. Long story short, this is a way to solve for optimal policy in heterogeneous agent models very, very fast. Of course, and let me just say, this is very important. It was very important that we started with this timeless approach, because if you just went straight to the standard Ramsey problem, or the standard Ramsey plan, which by the way is nested here if you just set the timeless penalties to zero, right? If you just did that, you would confound stabilization motives with time consistency problems. And there's a very long discussion in the representative agent New Keynesian or even business neoclassical real business cycle literature thinking about how to do perturbation methods correctly in these settings. Okay, great. And with that, I'm just going to show you here a very quick illustration. You still want to, so in red, it's the representative agent benchmark. We're feeding in a demand shock. In rank, you want to respond quite forcefully and implement the divine coincidence allocation, closing output and inflation gaps. In Hank, you want to lean against demand shock slightly less aggressively, but still, if you compare this with like Taylor rules, it's still very close to leaning heavily against them. And with that, let me conclude by saying, in this paper, we develop a timeless Ramsey approach, which at a high level lets you jointly think about these three dimensions of optimal monetary policy design: long-run inflation, targets, which we now need two of, and stabilization policy. To make this practical, we sort of leverage the sequence-based set of methods, and using all of this, we're trying to systematically revisit the New Keynesian consensus on optimal monetary policy. Thank you very much.